the topic that I want to talk about is a little bit different than the sorts of topics I normally talk about. And so I want to say a little bit about how I came to address this particular topic, that is, queer reading and the task of the preacher. About a year and a half ago, I was invited to give a lecture at another UCC seminary. I'll just leave it at that. I had, at that time, just finished the manuscript for my book, Practicing Safer Text, that Greg just mentioned, and so I devoted my lecture that evening to what I called a queer reading of certain biblical texts that I explore in that book, and in particular, that evening, the story of Lot's daughters in the book of Genesis. The lecture was generally well received, and after I had finished speaking, the audience engaged me in a lively session of question and answer. At a certain point during the dialogue, however, one of the seminary administrators, I won't say which one, raised his hand, and after complimenting me for what he called an interesting presentation, that's always a rather ambiguous word, interesting, he asked a polite but trenchant question. And here I'm going to take some liberties in explicating his question, but not, I think, in a way that is unfair to the questioner. Because one of the things he noted, correctly, was that my way of reading the text was not particularly conventional. The questions I was asking, the conclusions I was reaching, the academic dialogue partners I was choosing, all of this might make for a good presentation to faculty members and graduate students. But in the end, wasn't my interpretation necessarily of limited interest? What effects did I expect my interpretation to have? How widespread was its relevance? And in particular, given the fact that I teach at a seminary and was speaking in another seminary, what did it mean to carry out such an interpretation in the context of a seminary? What would my particular type of engagement with the biblical text do to assist those training for a vocation in religious leadership? Or to concretize the question further yet, what does queer reading have to do with the task of the preacher? Now, I have admittedly expanded upon the original question, but I have done so precisely because I take the question to be a serious one. I believe it was asked in good faith by an individual who, so far as I can tell, supports full inclusion in the church and equal access to all rights of the church for lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgendered folk. In other words, the question was not grounded, in my view, in homophobia. If anything, the motivation behind the question seemed to be more closely related to other concerns I hear raised from time to time about the potential relevance for ministry of a whole series of academic and theoretical discourses. Because of the particular questions I ask and the particular moves I make in my own research and writing, these concerns were now taking the form of a question about the significance of something called queer theory. But many variations on this concern also exist, and it's not uncommon for seminary faculty members to be asked today about the relevance of any number of theoretical discourses, postcolonial theory, psychoanalysis, process thought, the feminist analysis of gender, the philosophies of Derrida, Levinas, or Whitehead, or for that matter, the theologies of Origen or Catherine Keller. The list goes on and on. What is the relevance of any of this for the practice of Christian ministry? Now, you will no doubt be happy to hear that I do not intend to answer all of those questions this afternoon. I do wish to point out, however, that the questions seem to assume a certain common sense view as to what ministry and the training of ministers ought to look like. And they assume as well that if esoteric topics in the seminary classroom or an academic presentation pull us away from that common sense approach, those topics hinder rather than help our formation as transformative ministers. But the first of several points I want to make today is that even a cursory reflection on biblical literature may lead us to a different conclusion. After all, we derive our common sense about this world and about ministry in this world in part from things we have heard and from traditions we inhabit. To know our traditions and to live well our traditions are, of course, things we do as people of faith. And yet one of the things we learn from numerous biblical texts is that the things we have heard and the traditions we inhabit can sometimes mislead us. Indeed, biblical literature shows us that it is sometimes exactly the task of the preacher to point out how insufficient or even how wrong our most deeply held convictions, handed on by tradition, can be. In order to explore this point, I want to reflect briefly on several biblical texts, that being my profession. And since our concern here is with the task of the preacher, we might as well turn first to that biblical speaker who is sometimes referred to by Protestants as the preacher. I refer, of course, to Qohelet, the primary speaking subject of the biblical book of Ecclesiastes. The word Qohelet, as many of you know, was rendered the preacher by the King James Version, apparently under the influence of Luther's German rendering. And although most scholars today, including myself, I have to admit, consider this translation dubious linguistically and historically, its association with such important sources as Luther and the King James Version may at least justify a quick glance at Qohelet here in our reflection on the task of the preacher. Qohelet, you will recall, stands in the wisdom tradition. And this tradition generally seems to have assumed that the person who lives in a wise and righteous fashion will normally reap positive benefits, whereas the person who lives in a foolish or wicked fashion will normally reap negative consequences. Various wisdom texts, for example, from the book of Proverbs, can be read in support of such assertions, and other biblical texts from outside the wisdom tradition, such as the Deuteronomistic history and many of the prophets, also presuppose or assert a very similar structure of retribution and reward. Yet Qohelet points out that these assumptions, these biblical assumptions, often fail to hold true. Sometimes the wicked or foolish get along quite well, while the good and the wise have a much more difficult time. Thus we find this observation in chapter 8 of Ecclesiastes, which concludes with a very unexpected biblical recommendation for how one ought to live. I'm reading here from NRSV. There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people who are treated according to the conduct of the wicked, and there are wicked people who are treated according to the conduct of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. So I commend enjoyment, for there is nothing better for people under the sun than to eat and drink and enjoy themselves, for this will go with them in their toil through the days of life that God gives them under the sun. Or again, we have this observation in chapter 7, which also concludes with a most unexpected biblical recommendation. In my vain life, I have seen everything. There are righteous people who perish in their righteousness, and there are wicked people who prolong their life in evil doing. Do not be too righteous, and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be too wicked, and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you should take hold of the one without letting go of the other, for the one who fears God shall succeed with both. Now, if we had more time this afternoon, it might be worth our while to reflect further on the rather provocative recommendations that Qohelet makes in these passages. After all, when we hear the phrase, "the Bible says," we don't usually expect to hear the suggestions that there's nothing better in life than enjoying the pleasures of one's appetites, or that perhaps we should aim for moderation in both our vices and our virtues. The primary point I wish to underscore for the moment, however, is that Qohelet is, in these and other passages, interrogating the foundations of his own tradition. A member of the wisdom school, he proceeds on the basis of what we could call wisdom methods, for example, when he draws conclusions from his careful observations of the world and his experience. In that sense, he is, for a wisdom thinker, rather conventional. And yet the conclusions that he reaches and the recommendations that he makes are quite different from the conclusions and recommendations that his wisdom tradition, his biblical tradition, has taught him. Indeed, this is true already in the opening chapter, where this wisdom adherent makes the remarkable statement that in much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. I'm sure none of you have ever felt that. But such an assertion sounds very much like a direct challenge to a basic premise of wisdom literature. It would be difficult to square this skepticism about wisdom and knowledge with, for example, the lofty hymn to wisdom found in the first 9 chapters of Proverbs. What do we learn then about the task of preaching if we decide to follow the example of this biblical preacher? The preacher is here challenging the core convictions, the common sense of his own tradition. He is asking his audience to rethink the assumptions they have made, and he explains why he believes those assumptions, many of which are found in our Bibles, need to be rethought. Kohelet's tradition has been looking at the world one way, but now the preacher is suggesting that the world needs to be looked at in another way. And as a consequence of seeing the world in a new way, Kohelet proposes unexpected, even astonishing, courses of action. Now, perhaps it will be objected that I am here attempting a sleight of hand. For as interesting as Kohelet surely is, it is unlikely that anyone will confuse Kohelet with a homiletic handbook. I have myself already acknowledged that scholars no longer accept the King James translation, where we find Kohelet referred to as the preacher. And so my use of Kohelet to shed light on the task of the preacher may seem dubious to some. If I am not entirely persuaded by this objection, it is at least partly because I detect in the objection itself a certain formal similarity to the moves by which heteronormativity is most often consolidated. In biblical interpretation, as in the realm of sex and gender, orthodoxy usually dominates by dismissing the relevance of all counter-evidence, of all those pieces of the picture which don't quite fit preconceived notions of the norm, of all that seems, like Kohelet, a little bit queer. Indeed, one of my arguments in practicing safer text is that Kohelet is one of the biblical books that can most usefully be characterized as queer, and so I am not inclined to grant too quickly its irrelevance. But let us allow the objection. Let us look instead to another biblical text, one whose relevance for discerning the task of the preacher may be more easily granted, or at least less easily dismissed. Let us look to the Sermon on the Mount. For if the Christian preacher, at least, cannot look to a sermon of Jesus to discern her task, where can she look? When we examine chapters 5 through 7 of Matthew's Gospel, we notice that Jesus makes a number of different rhetorical moves in this famous sermon. For my purposes, the most significant passage occurs in the 5th chapter, where Jesus 6 times compares things that his audience has previously heard with things that Jesus now says. You have heard that it was said, but I say. This is how Jesus preaches. And in each case, Matthew's Jesus first refers to some teaching from Torah and then compares it with his own conclusion. These comparisons have been referred to traditionally as the antitheses of Matthew, but New Testament scholars actually adopt a wide range of views about the relationships between the two sides of these comparisons, so that one sometimes hears that Jesus interprets Torah, sometimes that Jesus alters Torah, sometimes that he radicalizes or sharpens it. It is sufficient to note here, however, that the conclusions Jesus reaches are indeed rather different from the conclusions one would likely reach solely on the basis of the Torah's plain sense. To take only one example, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the 2nd mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. Now this passage takes its point of departure, as all of you know, from actual Torah texts. It lifts out of context a saying that can be found in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. Its point of departure is thus the Jewish tradition that is so important for Matthew's gospel. But it is very far from being a straightforward repetition of tradition. Indeed, it moves beyond the reference to tradition and makes a point that, so far as I can see, no conventional reading of the plain sense of Scripture would automatically have reached. From the scriptural saying, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, one simply would not reach automatically the conclusion that one should turn the other cheek, that one should give more than one is sued for, that one should go twice as far as one is asked to go, that one should give to everyone who begs, or that one should not refuse anyone who wants to borrow. The hermeneutics of Matthew's Jesus, let us admit this, don't cohere very well with modern notions of exegesis. For he shows little interest here in the meaning that the Torah text might have had for its original author or audience. He seems rather much more concerned with how the text is being read in his own day. And more significantly, he seems to be challenging the prevailing views of his audience about the Torah text and their relevance that that audience reads or hears. He disrupts what must have been the conventional common sense interpretation of tradition on the part of his audience. Like Kohelet, he is asking his audience to rethink the assumptions they have previously been making on the basis of the traditions they have received, and this rethinking has implications for the actions that he recommends. Now, I want to suggest that a seminary education, at its best, will sometimes involve a structure very similar to the one we see in both the teaching of Kohelet and the preaching of Jesus. You have heard, but we say. And it is here, I believe, in the transition from what one has heard to what is now being said, that academic theories and discourses, including queer theory, queer reading, queer hermeneutics, sometimes play a crucial role. For such theories and discourses can help us to see limitations in the views that we have received. One does not encounter such theories because of any perverse inclination on the part of professors to subject students to arcane topics. I was paid to put that line in. Rather, such theories enable a shift from what one has heard in the past, and no doubt continues to hear, to what one needs to hear now. And this shift sheds light on important dimensions of the tasks of preaching and ministry. For example, you have heard that Judaism and Christianity tell us clearly what marriage is, always has been, and so always needs to be. But we say that a careful examination of biblical texts pertaining to sex and marriage, and a careful study of the history of Christian rites around marriage, friendship, and partnership will uncover a remarkable heterogeneity of views and practices. That queer theory, gender studies, and the history of Christian thought provide us with tools for analyzing this heterogeneity, and that any minister who wishes to address contemporary concerns and anxieties about marriage and family will need to take this heterogeneity into account. You have heard that sexuality is a private matter, which has no place in a seminary curriculum. But we say that normalizing assumptions about sexuality and its interrelations with gender, race, class, and religion already structure the ways in which we interact with one another on a daily basis in both private and public contexts. That queer theory helps us to analyze the consequences, which are often detrimental, and that no minister interested in the public role of religion should fail to take such matters into account. You have heard that the Bible condemns homosexuality, and hence that so must we. But we say not simply that very few biblical texts actually refer to same-sex sexual contact, though that is true, but also, and more importantly, that those texts which arguably do are structured on the basis of assumptions about gender and sexual practice, including assumptions about the subordination of women, that are quite different from those which we proclaim today. That queer theory, feminist and gender studies, the history of sexuality, and good old-fashioned biblical scholarship all help us to analyze these differences, and that careful attention to such differences should cause us not only to reconsider traditional views on homosexuality, but also to rethink our views about the kind of text we understand the Bible to be. To make these sorts of arguments, I want to suggest, is to adopt in today's world something like the critical, counter-conventional perspective that both Jesus and Kohelet adopted in their preaching. However, it may still be objected that queer questions are too narrow, since queer questions can take their point of departure from the lives and experiences of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgender persons. Such questions are frequently dismissed as being relevant, supposedly, for only a tiny segment of the population that the preacher must address. But there are difficulties with this objection, which are relevant for reflection on the task of the preacher. In the first place, we need to remember that good rhetoric, which is what good preaching is, always issues forth from a specific speaker who has been shaped by particular forces and wishes to address the concerns of a particular audience. This is perhaps most apparent in the case of another influential preacher from our tradition, the Apostle Paul. For the words associated with Paul mostly come to us in the form of letters, addressed specifically to first century churches and individuals. Just as Kohelet's message reflects the concerns of an early Jewish wisdom thinker addressing matters of particular interest to other wisdom thinkers, and just as Matthew's Jesus, the first century Jew, addresses in his sermon a specifically Jewish audience which assumes certain things about the importance of Torah, so also Paul addresses his message literally to very particular groups of people living in specific contexts. His famous letter to the Romans, for example, surely a foundational text for those of us who are Protestant, concludes with an entire chapter comprised of references to specific individuals. All three of these preachers, then, show us something crucial about the task of preaching. Preaching is always situated rhetoric. While it may raise critical questions about tradition and experience, it is nevertheless also shaped by particular traditions and experiences and addresses particular traditions and experiences. To note, then, that queer reading often takes its point of departure from reflection on specific experiences and contexts is not at all to cast doubt on its relevance for the seminary curriculum. Quite the contrary, it might even count as evidence for that relevance, since the skills honed by the practice of queer reading may prepare all of us better for the types of contextual analysis that are essential for any transformative ministry. On the other hand, while queer reading does derive much of its energy from the concerns of lesbians, gay men, bisexuals, and transgender folk, it hardly restricts itself to narrow understandings of those concerns or of their relevance. Indeed, just the opposite is true. Most often, queer analysis begins with a matter that may seem narrow in its implications, only to end up demonstrating that, in fact, the matter at hand is relevant for far larger numbers of people than we normally imagine. Consider, for example, and this was not pre-planned, the implications of the now frequent addition of the word transgendered to the phrase lesbians, gay men, and bisexuals. Queer thinking pushes us to consider quite broadly the possible implications of the term transgendered. For is it not the case, queer theorists ask, that the existence of people and practices we call transgendered cast doubt on the firm boundary that we often construct between male and female? Differences in sex and gender certainly exist, and a queer reading of the world takes those differences very seriously, but at the same time, queer thinking asks us to consider how our attempts to talk about and live with those differences create boundaries between people and boxes around people, people whose actual differences and similarities are more complex than our categories allow. Indeed, if we think about this long enough, we come to realize that the relationships which most of us have to sex and gender categories are more complex than our binary categories allow. Since all of us are encouraged to imagine our own lives in relation to rather rigidly defined categories of male and female, the queer demonstration that the categories of male and female are actually much less stable than we often imagine is potentially relevant for us all. Now, these kinds of observations can produce discomfort both for persons who identify themselves as straight and for persons who identify themselves as lesbian or gay, many of whom are not so eager to talk about transgender. But when queer theory or queer theology makes these arguments about the implications of transgender, it once again makes a move that has a parallel, or should have a parallel, in our preaching. For even if the preacher always begins in a certain location, and always begins with a certain audience, nevertheless, one crucial task of preaching is to ask that audience to think beyond the boundaries of its location, to trouble the boxes in which we place ourselves, and so to re-examine critically the walls and barriers that exist, or that the church sets up between itself and other people. Granted that all sorts of differences exist among us, how does our legitimate desire to recognize such differences end up on occasion strengthening barriers between us? How do our words and our actions solidify categories not only of gender, but also of class, race, religion, culture, categories that do get at real and important differences among us, but that nevertheless often turn complex and fluid differences into firmly bounded enclaves? In a world as diverse as our own, These are the sorts of critical questions that today's preacher must always be asking. And queer reading is one of the ways in which the seminary curriculum can help to foster the kind of critical analysis required to handle such questions. But perhaps it will be objected that such critical analysis may be okay for certain classrooms, but it has little relevance for real preaching. For it is often assumed that preaching has little, if any, role as critical analysis. Preaching seems to be understood by many as a time primarily for encouraging one's audience and making them feel good, providing them with a haven from the real-world circumstances with which they must deal on a weekly basis. In much the same way, I might add, lesbian and gay studies courses are sometimes misunderstood as nothing more than opportunities for the encouragement of lesbians and gay men. The idea that preaching could properly make parishioners uncomfortable, and the idea that a seminary classroom making use of contemporary theory could properly make students uncomfortable, are ideas that many would reject. Our vocation, it will surely be said by someone, is to comfort, not to cause controversy, to care for, and not to offend. Now, there is no question about the fact that encouragement and comfort are sometimes necessary tasks for preaching. Comfort, comfort my people, says God in Isaiah 40. Weep with those who weep, says Paul in Romans 12. And one of the reasons why we take pastoral care and engage in CPE is to learn to carry out these mandates better. Nevertheless, the notion that we should never make others uncomfortable is clearly contradicted by all three of the biblical preachers I have referred to this afternoon. Kohelet's rather queer biblical emphasis on the enjoyment of food, drink, and bodily pleasure was fiercely condemned by the Wisdom of Solomon, a Jewish wisdom text that is considered canonical by many Christians. The example of Jesus shows quite clearly what those of us who claim to be his followers ought to expect so far as the reactions of others to our preaching are concerned. For until we are put to death, we have little reason to believe that we have yet made others as uncomfortable with our preaching as Jesus did with his. And such traditions as we have about Paul, the author of that admonition in Romans 12 to weep with those who weep, testify to the fact that he understood this. For according to Acts, Paul continued to preach even while placed under house arrest. And according to Clement, Paul was martyred by the Roman emperor. To complain then that either queer reading or one's preaching makes a lot of people uncomfortable is hardly to make any biblical argument against them, and certainly not any argument that should carry much force in the UCC, where the fine tradition of making others uncomfortable has been fostered for many years. We may not assume that every minister must be making others uncomfortable all the time. As Paul also rightly notes, again in Romans 12, we have many different gifts and many different ministries, but those gifts and ministries will sometimes take the form of making others uncomfortable, and even quite angry. Now, this ministry of making others uncomfortable does present certain challenges to the livelihood of the preacher. Not to speak of the seminary fundraiser. And these challenges may cause some to object that the biggest problem with queer reading is not just that it makes others uncomfortable, but that it seems, perhaps like the rhetoric of queer professors, so thoroughly unrealistic. For if we are concerned about what some folks at my seminary call ministry for the real world, what shall be the point of preaching sermons so controversial that we may soon no longer have a pulpit? In the real world, it will surely be said, and is frequently said, one must be realistic. Only preachers who can keep a pulpit have any chance to effect transformation. Now, this objection needs to be taken seriously, and the call for careful attention to context on the part of the preacher needs to be joined to recognition of the importance of thinking about our rhetoric pragmatically. It is certainly the case that any kind of rhetoric, and I include here both preaching and teaching, must be formulated in such a way as to take one's context and audience into account. If one truly wants to persuade, which is what rhetoric does, one will indeed have to think carefully about the rightly chosen word at any particular moment. Nevertheless, and this will be my closing point, ministry for our world must always inhabit a paradoxical tension. We must always attempt to understand and respond pragmatically to our world, while also keeping in mind Paul's admonition again in Romans 12, that we are not to be conformed to that world. This is no doubt a challenge, but paradoxical tension is, after all, inherent to Christian testimony. For Christians confess both that Christ has already come and yet that Christ is still coming. Old things have passed away, all things have become new, yet in many respects we continue to groan with all of creation for a redemption that is still arriving. This is the witness of the biblical tradition. This is what we preach. We should therefore not allow ourselves to be trapped into deciding between pragmatic decisions in the real world and that future toward which we are already trying to order our lives. To borrow the words of Kohelet, it is good that we should take hold of the one without letting go of the other, with the confidence that the one who serves God shall succeed with both. And as we attempt to do so, queer reading, far from standing in our way, may prove to be an invaluable guide. Queer reading, after all, asks us to take the realities of sexual practice and desire seriously while living our way into a world in which current sexual realities would no longer normalize us in just the ways that they currently do. Queer reading asks us to take the current structuring of our world on the basis of male and female seriously while living our way into a world in which the boxes of sex and gender would no longer discipline us in just the ways that they currently do. Queer reading, therefore, gives us tools, even for understanding the message of someone like Paul, who, after all, incorporates assumptions about male and female, sometimes with very problematic consequences, and yet who does preach the very unrealistic message that for the Christian there is no longer Jew or Greek, slave or free, or male and female. Queer reading, therefore, gives good practice and necessary resources to those of us who, in the best traditions of the UCC, the Reformed tradition, and indeed of Christianity, wish to practice ministry in and for our world while refusing to be conformed to it. Thank you.